US influence in the region. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صلاة.
The Syrian Journalists Union organized a central solidarity stand in support of Palestinian journalists at the General Organization of Radio and Television Building in Damascus. The stand was in response to a call from the International Federation of Journalists to observe a minute of silence in mourning for the journalist martyrs who were murdered by the Israeli occupation since the beginning of its war on Gaza. At 12 p.m., all media workers across Syria stood in silence for a minute, holding signs condemning the blatant Israeli aggression targeting Palestinian journalists and demanding an end to the aggression on Gaza and the West Bank.
This stand by Syrian journalists and media professionals is an expression of our complete and absolute support for the Palestinian Journalists Union, the Arab Journalists Union, and the International Federation of Journalists. It is a call to document the Israeli crimes against Palestinian journalists, as no other journalists in history have been killed in military confrontations like Palestinian journalists have been.
Syrian journalists affirm that Palestine is Syria's central cause, for which blood has been shed and sacrifices have been made. Today's stand aims to shed light on the systematic targeting of Palestinian journalists by the Israeli occupation, which has killed over 130 journalists since October the 7th. Participants praised the courage and sacrifices of their Palestinian colleagues who have replaced ink with their own blood in the pursuit of the just struggle and the honor of their profession.
These are the heroes who have been targeted by the occupation through assassination and bombardment because they have conveyed the truth about the massacres committed by the Zionist enemy. Today, Syrian journalists stand together in every newsroom, in front of cameras, and at their workplaces, observing a moment of silence, here specifically in front of the Syrian Press Martyrs Board, because the martyrs of truth are the beacons of light that illuminate the path of justice.
Syria has sacrificed dozens of journalist martyrs on the path of truth during over 13 years of its war against the terrorism supported by the West and specifically Israel. Today, Syrian journalists affirmed their unwavering support for their Palestinian brothers in their struggle against Zionist terrorism. Syrian journalists have gathered at this symbolic place in solidarity with their Palestinian counterparts who bravely resist the Israeli aggression with their words and cameras. They have unequivocally confirmed that the truth will prevail and justice will triumph. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
On Monday, the Hague-based International Court of Justice heard the final day of submissions on the legal consequences of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories since 1967. Over the 6 days of the public hearings, 52 nations and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the Arab League and African Union presented their arguments to the court. The first to speak on the final day of the ICJ hearings was the Turkish representative who joined a large number of nations condemning Israel's decades-long brutal policies in the Palestinian territories. Ankara pointed the finger at those nations which won't stop supporting Tel Aviv, despite 30,000 innocent people have been killed in the Gaza Strip.
Those who should lead are well known. The Israeli supporters in the Security Council, it is their responsibility. Indeed, most of the international community is aware of this injustice and is trying to do something.
Palestinian representatives opened the proceedings on Monday last week by accusing Israel of having subjected Palestinians to decades of discrimination, leaving them with the choice of displacement, subjugation, or death. 2 days later, the UK asked the court not to offer an opinion at all on the legal consequences of Israel's occupation.
Unfortunately, the UK came with the political arguments, and here we are in a legal body. Unfortunately, their legal argument was very weak, and we believe that the court will dismiss it. The Israeli practices and measures and its presence in the occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful, and unlawfulness should have consequences.
This ICJ case was prompted by the UN General Assembly in December 2022, and it is different from another ICJ case filed by South Africa, which has accused Israel of genocide in Gaza. Outside the court, activists showed their support to besieged Palestinians during all days of proceedings.
There's also not an excuse for the other countries to say, well, we are not complying with this legal system that we all agreed upon.
I'm here to just show the support, to say to the whole world that the genocide should stop, and this is the only way actually to support our people in Palestine, in Gaza.
The court is expected to issue its advisory opinion on Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories within 6 months. Despite having no binding force, the court's opinions nevertheless carry great legal weight and moral authority. However, it must be said, the ICJ has no enforcement arm. Max Civili, The Hague.
No picket lines over the weekend, but the strike action is on. Thousands of National Health Service junior doctors, who form half of the doctors' workforce in England, walk off the job. Their demands, the same as the last time we talked to them.
Because of this erosion of pay over all this time, we've been seeing problems with staff recruitment and retention, and we've been hemorrhaging people either out of medicine completely or to other countries that are willing to recruit us and pay us basically the rates we were being paid 15 years ago. And so the message from the BMA has always been to try and get that pay back to 2008 levels.
In other words, a 35% pay rise to make up for previous below-inflation pay rises. An extra 3% on top of the average of nearly 9% received last year was being discussed before talks between the government and the BMA, the trade union for doctors, broke down in December. But the walkouts come at a cost. They're happening at a critical time of year when hospitals are especially busy dealing with the challenges of the cold season and with an NHS waiting list at a staggering 7.6 million. Over 1.3 million hospital appointments had to be rescheduled since the industrial action began over a year ago. And yet, the striking doctors continue to enjoy the support of over half of Britons.
The doctors say they're doing this to bring the government back to the negotiating table and to get it to recognize their value. They're also saying that feeling undervalued and being underpaid is pushing them to seek jobs abroad.
The BMA says 4 in 10 doctors plan to leave the NHS at the first opportunity. The government says it won't negotiate while the strikes are ongoing.
There's an overall focus on privatization, which means the health care insurance companies will be taking over many aspects of the running and resources of health. And that's led to record low wages, especially compared to a massive inflation and cost of living crisis, so that it no longer justifies the cost of training in terms of the actual remuneration. Medical students are leaving with medical school with £100,000 worth of debt, and they're not looking to pay that off for well over a decade. Whereas if they go to other countries simply next door, Ireland or Australia, they can immediately double their wage.
The British government seems nowhere near loosening its purse strings. But the consensus is that the longer these strikes grind on, the wider the damage. Saipur is up, London.
People are preparing for the Friday's elections, in which they will vote for their representatives in Parliament and Assembly of Experts. Thousands of candidates, including women and the young generation, are vying for the seats.
Nearly 15,000 candidates are running for the election. Of these candidates, 12% are women and 63% belong to the young generation, which includes young activists aged between 30 and 50 years old.
Islami also mentioned different political groups and parties that are participating in the upcoming elections.
All of the country's political spectrums, including principalists, reformists, and independents, are among the candidates. A close contest is underway among them in the country's different zones and cities. According to the law, the parties can support a list of candidates as well as introducing their intended candidates.
In the meantime, 200 local channels have been launched for the candidates' election campaign.
The IRIB has launched 200 local channels, and the candidates can use them for their campaigns as well as the radio and social media.
Nearly 40 elections have been held in Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, which is a symbol of people's power and presence in the country's sensitive occasions. Iranians across the country will participate in the elections as they see choosing their representatives, both in the parliament and assembly of experts, as a duty to maintain the basis of religious democracy in their country. Farzana Ashuryun, Tehran.
Election in view of Imam Khomeini and Ayatollah Khamenei. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The 12th round of parliamentary election and the 6th round of the Assembly of Experts election will be held in Iran on March 1, 2024. The Iranian people will go to ballot boxes to elect the candidates of the Islamic Council Assembly, called Majlis, and the Assembly of Experts. This will once more manifest the unity of the followers of various faiths, religious sects and ethnicities in the vast Iranian land. The Islamic Council Assembly, Majlis, is one of the three branches of power according to the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran. It is the main basis of legislature in the country, and the members of the Majlis are elected with the direct votes of people for a four-year term. The Assembly of Experts, however, is a unique body in Iran which has been shaped since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This organization has the duty of appointment of leader and supervision of the leader's performance. It can also dismiss the leader when needed. According to the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran, during the time of occultation of Imam Mahdi, the 12th infallible Imam from the Prophet's progeny, the country and the Islamic Ummah is led by a just and God-wary jurisprudent. He is aware of the circumstances of time, is brave, and a prudent administrator. Such a jurisprudent is elected by the Assembly of Experts, as they are specialized in finding the qualifications for the most important position in the country. The members of the Assembly of Experts are elected for an 8-year term. Among the most important reasons for election in the Islamic Republic of Iran, as a religious rule, are the emphasis of the Quran and the narrations from the Prophet and his 12 infallible successors, blessings of God upon them. God says in verse 11 of chapter Ra'd of the Noble Quran, "Indeed, Allah does not change a people's lot unless they change what is in their souls." Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, also says, "No people consults except that is guided to the best way." In addition, Imam Ali, peace upon him, said that if there were not the big number of those who swear allegiance, he would abandon caliphate and rule of the Islamic Ummah. Moreover, Prophet has said elsewhere, "Whoever starts his day while he is indifferent towards the affairs of Muslims, he is not a Muslim." According to the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, and his successor, Ayatollah Khamenei, too, elections are very important. Imam Khomeini used to emphasize on the high status and role of elections and would persuade everybody to take part in all elections. The Imam would consider election as one of the honors of the Islamic Republic system. He said that election is a picture of freedom and independence of the country. He made it clear several times that no one, including the ulema and the elite, is entitled to impose their view on people, and it is people who have the right to shape their fate. In view of this, the Imam said, "We have no right. God the Exalted has not granted us the right. The Prophet of Islam has not given us the right to impose anything upon our nation." Elsewhere, Imam Khomeini said, "The authority should be in people's hand. This is a rational issue. Every wise person accepts this issue, that the ordainments of everyone should be in his own hand." Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei also puts high emphasis on elections. He said, "The prime importance of election is because election is the trench of country. People's presence at ballot boxes immunizes the fate of nation and people and prevents the enemy from invasion, aggression, and further impudence." The leader said nearly 20 years ago, "Our country relies on people's votes. The reason why the enemies of the nation and those who look avariciously at this land have failed to deal any harm to it is the presence, will, and participation of people in different scenes." In view of the leader, elections are among the faithful and sensitive arenas of the country. He calls elections as the night of Qadr of the Islamic system, since it determines the affairs of the country for 4 years. He says, "The republicanism and Islamism of the system both depend on election because materialization of republicanism and Islamism and the rule of people in the administration of the country has no way but holding of election." Ayatollah Khamenei says elsewhere, "Election is injection of fresh blood into the body of the Islamic Republic system. It is the renewal of power and force for the nation. Election means this. It means injecting a new spirit, a new blood, and a new breath into the country, into the nation, and into the people. This is election." Ayatollah Khamenei clarifies election as follows. "It is both a right and an obligation for people to come and determine the fate of their country carefully, as the country belongs to the people. People should come and, through correct and free election, determine the lawmakers in the legislature, determine their directors as it has been assigned in the law. This is the people's right and it belongs to them, but it is an obligation too. It is not that one says, 'I don't want to apply my right.' No, the fate of the system depends on application and wielding of this right. This is an obligation. Everyone should participate. Election is both the right of nation and a national duty. The Islamic Republic system has annulled the systems which appoint power, and it granted the people's election a role in the administration of the country. This is the right of each person in the country to be able to elect and play a role in determining the manager of the country. Furthermore, it is a duty too, because this participation can keep alive the spirit of vividness and sense of responsibility in the society forever, and it can manifest people's presence boastfully in the face of the enemies of this nation. Election is not a mere duty. It is not a mere right either. It is both your right and a public duty." Ayatollah Khamenei says on the status of election, election per se is the symbol of national might. If the dear Iranian nation manages to bring its ample votes to the scene in this election, and the people's presence is spectacular, this will be the greatest symbol of might and national dignity. The leader maintains that broad participation in election will ensure the country, as he says, people's presence in election will ensure the country de facto. Election is the real indicator of people's presence in the country's political scene. Every election which is held fervently will ensure the country. In his recent remarks to the visiting people of East Azerbaijan province, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Everyone should participate in the election. Election is the main basis of the Islamic Republic system. Election is the course of the country's reform. Those who intend to solve problems and to repair, they should come to election. The accurate way is to elect."
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Genocidal war in Gaza continues for the 145th day, with the death toll nearing 30,000. The U.S. president had a few words to say about a truce deal that's being discussed. Licking on some ice cream, he said that there will be a truce by Monday. Well, this goes flat against what Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh has said, and also the Hamas rep in Lebanon, Osama Hamdan. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the genocidal war and how nothing has prevented civilian killings, from the ICJ to protests to a possible truce deal, a genocide made possible by the U.S. providing the Israeli regime with bombs and missiles. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. John Phoenix, journalist and international relations expert, joins us from London. Also joining us is Nicholas Davis, independent journalist and author, who joins us from Miami. Well, welcome to you both. If I may start with you, John Phoenix, when we take a look at what's happening in Gaza, it's quite incredible and shocking that we're approaching 30,000 in terms of the death toll, 145 days now, and just in the past 24 hours, over 100 Palestinians have been murdered. What do you think about the fact that nothing is preventing the genocide from stopping?
Well, just make it clear that the main factor on the support for the Israeli army genocide in Gaza is obviously the American government. If the United States wanted to end this massacre, want to end this genocide, you only had to pressure the Israelis and stop their sending daily ammunition and daily support for the Israelis. In fact, they're clear now from the reports that even the from the last, I think, what, 26 of December till now, Israel did not, after the CCJ, start killing the Palestinians. You know, so the only pressure can actually stop the Zionist entity killing more Palestinians is the Americans. Because on the other hand, you have the neighboring Arab regimes, who is actually, as clear now from what's happening, 145 days, they are obviously American puppet who cannot take any decision. They fail even to actually smuggle, not even deliver, smuggle a glass of water to the Palestinians who are starving in Gaza, especially the north of Gaza, obviously no feed, food at all. People dropping dead on the north because of the lack of food and medicine and water. They starvation became a weapon now in the hand of the Israelis, because they make it clear, as one of their member of the parliament said, if we starve them, they will be able to come and give us information about Hamas. So it's actually intent to starve people to death. You know? So the way out of this misery is only the Americans, the government who are sponsoring this massacres, who are sponsoring this genocide.
Sure, sure. Well, let's talk a little bit more on the humanitarian level before we get into the American complicity, I should say. And Nicholas Davies, when you take a look at, for example, the UN organizations, you had a recent incident on February the 5th where the Israeli regime forces fired at the UN convoy that was carrying vital supplies of food for the starving Palestinians. And at the same time, the regime forces, they blocked these trucks. And that has led many to say food is being used as a weapon of war. So much so that the humanitarian organizations are saying, you know, we're not going to be able to function in the Gaza Strip as it is. It's been almost impossible. Why do you think Israel is using food as a weapon of war? I guess they talked about how it wants to extract information on Hamas, but is that the only reason?
Well, no, of course not. And I mean, this is an integral part of why the ICJ has essentially accepted that this is a case of genocide, because clearly the intent is to completely destroy Gaza and kill thousands of civilians. You know, this is not what the Americans like to call collateral damage. These are actually the targets. Under whatever pretext the Israelis come up with, the goal is to make Gaza uninhabitable and to inflict so much death and destruction and sheer terror on the people of Gaza that eventually Israel will be able to push them out into Egypt or just out into the desert. None of the pretexts cited have any validity whatsoever. This is genocide, pure and simple.
You talked about the U.S. assistance, John Phoenix. Maybe you could expand a little bit more about how vast this is. I mean, we have at some point a Pentagon spokesman said that the security assistance continues to arrive on a near daily basis to the Israeli regime. Throughout this time, the U.S. is saying, not throughout this time really, but in the past month or so, that it says it's telling Israel to really watch out for the civilian casualties. But it continues to supply Israel, not just sporadically, but almost on a daily basis, if not daily. How much of a contributing factor is that to the genocide taking place?
Well, from the beginning of genocide, from the October, when the Americans actually noted that the Israelis killing civilians, they did not actually stop the Israelis killing civilians. They actually deny the figures. If you remember, Biden said, I do not obviously believe Hamas figures. These figures was coming from the United Nations and other independent organizations who were saying the civilian being targeted, houses being demolished, children and women being killed, hundreds of kids under the rivers. So the Americans know that there is, when I say Americans, I mean the American government, they know that there is targeting deliberately civilians. That's explain why they, that's obviously explain why they have 8,800 women, you know, killed, 7,000 children killed. So 75% of the casualty in Gaza, they are civilians. And under the pretext of fighting Hamas, there's no Hamas to fight, you know, I don't see...
Okay, we're interrupting our normal programming to bring you coverage of Election Day in Iran. Today, Friday, 1st of March 2024, is Election Day, the 12th Parliamentary Majlis elections and the 6th Assembly of Experts elections are being held today, Friday, 1st of March, throughout the Islamic Republic of Iran. Well, live, we're now going over live to our correspondent, Atefer Fani, in a polling station in Tehran, in northern Tehran. Let's go over to our correspondent. And Atefer Fani, if you can hear me, just describe to us what's going on where you are. What's happening there?
Mr. Derakhshan, today Iranians have gone to the polls to choose the members of the Majlis, or the Iranian parliament, and also the Assembly of Experts for the next 4 years, as the country reiterates its commitment to a constitutional principle stipulating that the affairs of the country must be administered by relying on people's votes. And as you might have heard, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, cast his vote early this morning during the first minutes of the elections, urging people to cast their votes as soon as possible. He prayed to Almighty God to make today a blessed day for the Iranian nation. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "Our dear people should know that the eyes of people around the world, both ordinary citizens and political figures, are on Iran today." He said, "They want to see what choices you make in these elections and what the outcome will be." And Mr. Rashand, here I am at a polling station in northern Tehran, and since early in the morning, I can see people from all strata coming one by one to cast their ballots to choose the members of the Majlis, or the Iranian Parliament, as well as the Assembly of Experts for the next 4 years. And what is interesting to me is the fervent presence of first-time voters. I mean, those who are now 18 years old and are actually eligible to vote. Their presence in this polling station and all polling stations around the world is very interesting. They have come to the polls to show the world that they are the ones who should decide for their country, for the fate of their country, actually much to the chagrin of the enemies of the Islamic Republic. And as you might know, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in a recent meeting with a visiting group of the families of Iranian martyrs, as well as first-time voters, said strong and fervent elections constitute one of the pillars of running the country properly. The leader said, if we can show the world that the nation is present in the country's critical and decisive scenes, we have saved and moved the country forward. Mr. Rashande?
Right, Atefer. Can you tell us how many candidates are contesting these parliamentary majlis elections, and how many of those candidates are women?
Yes, figures by Iran's Interior Ministry show that nearly 15,000 candidates have been approved to compete in the parliamentary elections this year. Among them, 1,713 are women, and that's the record since the victory of the Islamic Revolution 45 years ago. The candidates compete for 290 seats of the parliament, five of which represent religious minorities, namely Jews, Assyrians, Zoroastrians, and Armenians. They are elected for a four-year term. Hundreds of candidates are also vying for 88 seats in Iran's Assembly of Experts, a body with an eight-year mandate that is in charge of overseeing the activities of the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Thanks very much for that report from our correspondent, Atefer Fani, at a polling station in northern Tehran. Thanks very much, Atefer, for that. And Once again, today is election day in the Islamic Republic of Iran. These are very important elections. Friday, 1st of March, is election day. The 12th parliamentary majlis elections are being held today. 290 parliamentary seats throughout the country are being contested today. And a very respectable 15,000 candidates are vying for these 290 seats. Now, that's roughly, for every seat, there's roughly about 50 contestants for every seat. And as we heard Artificer, over 1,700 of those 15,000 candidates are women. And we have over 1,700 women contesting these parliamentary seats. And we also have, simultaneously, the 6th Assembly of Expert elections today. They're also being held. And the Assembly of Experts oversees the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and that's also a very important body. And elections are being held for the Assembly of Experts today as well. Now, just a brief recap, 59,000 voting stations and voting booths have been set up throughout the country, up and down the country, and all Iranians can vote, those eligible can vote at those 59,000 voting stations and voting booths. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was among the first people to vote today at 8 a.m. This morning. He voted. He urged the Iranian people to take this opportunity and to cast their ballot. He said, I wish the Iranian people would make friends happy and disappoint the ill-wishers by exercising their right to vote and taking part in these elections. A huge turnout, of course, will disappoint the enemies of the Islamic Republic. And that's a brief recap. Thanks very much. We'll be going back to our regular programming now.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
In Israel, continuing to do that, continuing to work with the Israelis to help them to use these U.S. weapons to kill more Palestinians. I heard yesterday a friend of a friend who works in Florida here for a company called L3 Harris, who his friend believes is currently in Israel because L3 Harris helps to build the so-called Iron Dome Israeli and, you know, missile defense system. So there are American technicians in Israel working to maintain the weapons that are sold there, and there are intelligence officials and senior military officers helping Israel to plan and target these weapons on civilians in Gaza. Now, when it comes to Aaron Bushnell, since October, I believe, he had been under orders to be prepared to deploy to the Middle East or to Israel. So he explicitly, was implicated. The Air Force unit that he works with was on deck to be sent to the Middle East to take part in this war. He probably more than most Americans felt complicit, because actually, in fact, he is implicit. The Air Force that he is part of is part of the war. And I thought his statement on Facebook before he did this was just incredibly eloquent. He said, how many times have we all asked ourselves, what would we do if, you know, we were alive at the time of slavery of African Americans sure. in America, or if we were, you know, in Germany taking part in the genocide or hearing about the genocide that their country was committing. And he said, well, we don't have to wonder anymore. He said, every one of you can now answer the question, what are you doing mm-hmm. while your country is committing genocide? And the answer is, obviously, for most Americans, it is little or nothing, or even actually supporting it.
Indeed.
So that is the answer to the question. And I mean, I had a conversation with somebody yesterday who talked about how terrible Trump is, and I said, well, you know, Biden is clear. How
right.
can anybody be worse than a president who is committing genocide?
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, we're looking at another instance that we can make a comparison here, John Phoenix, to go along the same topic, and that is back in 2003, where you had Rachel Corrie. I don't know if you recall what
yes.
she did at that
yes.
point. And I'm going to refer to what she said then. I think it's a good idea for us all to drop everything and devote our lives to making this stop. I don't think it's an extremist thing to do anymore. Fast forward to 2024 with Aaron Bushnell. Compared to what people have been experiencing in Palestine at the hands of their colonizers, this is not extreme at all. You have these two instances happen, but yet U.S. politicians, Joe Biden, you know, he's not made really any, not really, he hasn't made any reaction or statements on what has happened. Why do you think this has been the case, and why do you think all these years you still are getting the silence from the U.S. government on people who are sacrificing themselves for causes that they believe in like this?
Well, if you look at the case of Rachel Corrie, when she was in Gaza, the way she was killed, that she was trying to stop a bulldozer of actually destroying a house. And the driver actually drove over her, killed her. It was clear that she was shouting, making it clear that she's in front of him. He ignored her, obviously, warning to him, and managed to kill her. Now, not only that the soldier killed her, when the family decided to take the army to court, the American officials were siding with the Israelis against an American citizen. You know, it take maybe 6-7 meetings with the their solicitor in Tel Aviv, and it was clear that the American officials, especially from the American embassy, taking the side of the Israelis. The only crime she committed is that she tried to protect a family where she stayed, actually having to stay in few houses in Gaza to help the Palestinian refugees, and that's what happened. So obviously the American government had a barrage of threat and pressure from the Zionist lobby not to side with the victims, side with Israel. And that's what happened. It was clear that AIPAC was working hard to be sure that the Israelis would not be indicted in that crime.
Sure. Well, we are looking now at what's been coming out from Paris, the news that has now been spread in the past couple of days regarding a possibility of a truce, which there are differing signals, the divisiveness between what the Americans have said, even the Qataris, and what Hamas and the resistance has said. Nicholas Davies, and I'd like to get your reaction to it, because on the one hand, Joe Biden, and I can't believe that they actually, it doesn't look good when the president is licking an ice cream and answering reporters talking about Palestinians and it just doesn't look good. Correct me if I'm wrong. But he said that there's a deal on Monday, and yet you have Hamas that came out hours later practically and said that there's still large gaps remain, kind of the same type of reaction that Hamas had to the previous truce. Tell us what you think about what's out there regarding this so-called truce that's in the works.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this has been going on for weeks, that the U.S., will come out with saying that, you know, there is some sort of deal on the table, but when you look at the details, it's clear that there isn't, and that essentially they are trying to impose on Hamas an agreement in which Hamas would release the Israeli hostages in exchange for a temporary truce, and then the bombing and Israeli assault would recommence. Hamas has clearly rejected that over and over and over again, and Hamas demands what the whole world is demanding, which is an actual ceasefire, an end to the genocide. And the U.S. is complicit also in fostering a view of this whole crisis that implies a reciprocity between the actions of Hamas on October the 7th and Israel's genocide and war crimes. And in fact, the Secretary General of the UN was absolutely explicit in introducing one of the UN Security Council sessions, which the US eventually vetoed, and he said, you know, yes, we condemn what Hamas did on October the 7th, but Israel's obligations under international humanitarian law are independent of whatever happened on October the 7th. Mm-hmm. And they do not depend on any kind of reciprocity. We are talking about enforcing international law, enforcing the Genocide Convention. It does, you know, in terms of stopping genocide, it actually does not matter what Hamas did, because they do not provide, what Hamas did does not provide, cannot provide a legitimate pretext for genocide.
Right. Well, it seems like throughout the questions that I've asked and the responses that I've gotten, we can't escape the role that the U.S. Has played, John Phoenix, in this. And the U.S. itself was a focus of the most recent G20 meeting that was held in Brazil, so much so that the Brazilian president came out, talked about the U.S. role there, and actually then made the focus of the G20, in some sense, the reform of the U.N., because the Brazilian president and the other officials that were present there, aside from looking down at the U.S., have said this is where the U.N. has failed. It needs to be reformed. We've heard that before about the U.N. being reformed, but here is a clear example of how bad things can go. What do you think about nothing to have at this point prevented the genocide from stopping?
Well, can I just highlight one thing before I answer the question? You sound like little best of Ryan's about the ice cream incident, you know. I mean, you're talking to about a president who is actually forget what he ate in the morning. When he came to the media and talking about genocide, he knows what the issue, killing civilians, starvation, and he's eating ice cream, which is an insult. that remind me of the when I watch the Schindler List, and one of the Nazi officers attacking an old lady and the other officer laughing, you know. This is really disgusting to see a president of a United States talking about an issue which is killing, genocide, starvation, and eating ice cream. That is really a shame, you know. But I do not really obviously blame him. I mean, he just mentioned that he met Mitterrand in the conference in France. With Mitterrand died 30 years ago. He called Sisi president of Mexico. So do not blame him for that, please. You know, yeah. In regard to Brazil, not only Brazil, even Algeria. Tablet a decision, a motion that this genocide should be stopped, you know, because there's no end to this cycle. Israelis have a free hand. They know that the Americans will veto any decision. Now, talking about the reform of the United Nations, and I mean, anybody can ask the same question, is how come 30 countries, 40, 120 countries will take a decision to stop a genocide? And then one country can override this decision. Surely we need to have a reform where other countries who are not sitting there like sheep, you know, and four countries control the United Nations, you know. So it is really time for reform and time for other countries to have its say on international affairs.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to have to end in there. Let me thank John Phoenix, journalist and international relations expert. And thank you, Nicholas Davies, independent journalist and author from Miami. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tawe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice